We haven't really had a chance to think about whether the services that we provide, the 29 or 30 programs around New Mexico that work with victims, whether those services are really working. And we are happy to report that research shows that when our programs are helping victims to be socially connected, helping them become more stable, giving them safety, a sense of hope and self-efficacy, that those factors lead directly to increased emotional well-being for victims and their children and reduces overall future violence. So it would be hard to find a clearer connection between what domestic violence programs are doing in New Mexico and really excellent outcomes.
What do we think about as the goal? Is the goal reducing violence and reducing future violence, and can we even measure that? Or is the goal getting the woman out of the situation that she's in?
The goal is obviously, overarching goal is that there will be less violence. And that depends, of course, very much on working with offenders who are the sole cause of domestic violence. But with working with victims, the goal is often that they have some sense of control over their lives, that they have some sense of hope, that they have some sense that they can live apart from the abuser and that they can parent their children well. It's well-being. And what victims need is what we all need, right? Which is a sense that things can be better and that we can make it. And that outcome alone by itself with nothing else, in our view, is sufficient, even if it isn't attached to any sort of reduction in cost. It's enough just to say that people feel safe and happy. And when that happens, you have safe, happy communities. And that's the goal.
Okay. Is there any measurement of going to court or not going to court of the number of violence incidents that turn up in court?
Not many incidents wind up in court, and there are lots of reasons for that, not the least of which is that the court doesn't do a very good job of dealing with victims of domestic violence. If you were, for example, being threatened by, Sammy the Bull Gravano, the court would really do everything possible to help you, right? Give you a fake name, give you 24-hour secret service or protection, maybe move you. But domestic violence victims get nothing like that. They're called to the courthouse and they are asked to tell judges what happened, even though they know that retaliation is very likely. So going to court is a very scary and can be an unsafe act for a victim. Also, courts tend to look at individual incidents. Someone was hit, someone was punched, someone was, thrown down the stairs. Every incident is a single incident, and domestic violence isn't really like that. It's many incidents. Some will be violent, some will be threats of violence, some may be nothing more than a look, and it's much more difficult for a court to see the patterns that make up domestic violence.
Do batterers get into batterers intervention programs without going to court?
There are a few, and I emphasize the word few, batterers that get into these programs because they want to change. But mostly, without the prospect of consequences, there is little motivation for a batterer to go into a program. For most abusers, their behavior works. They get what they want. There's no reason to change unless they are caught and held to account. So really, court is the way that most get into those programs.
Tell me a little bit about what we have in New Mexico in terms of services for victims.
This year, the Legislative Finance Committee is conducting an evaluation of domestic violence, both services to victims and services to offenders. And we're really happy about that because we have the research to show that the services provided, when done well, really do help reduce violence and increase overall well-being of children and their parents. So we're looking forward to hearing those results. And we're also looking forward to hearing what comes out of the discussion about batterers intervention and what works. And we've already talked about that extensively. But it comes to mind that, first, I'd like to say that I think LFC is doing a good job with this process, and I think we'll come up with some really good recommendations. But, you know, sometimes these larger questions about effectiveness, especially as they pertain to batterer's intervention, you know, you have to wonder what they're really about. So let me try to say it this way. Here's how I view this. Having worked with batterers for many years, I understand some of what motivates them, what they believe, how they justify their actions, and how we can move them to change. And I see a parallel, frankly, between how we work with batterers and how our, what I would refer to as, in some cases, a kind of abusive political leadership is operating. For example, it's awfully hard to say to someone, we're going to take away your heat, your Social Security, you know, no high blood pressure medication for you. But to justify that, you have to have a reason. And one of the reasons that I've heard batterers use and that I've heard the political leadership use is this. It's really only natural. This kind of inequality is just the way things are. And some people are deserving and some people are not. We can't help that. That's how we were made. That's how it is, right? God or whatever made us better than other people. And there are politicians who espouse those kinds of beliefs, who read them, who pass them on. So it's sort of like whatever you have is what you ought to have. Mm-hmm. And that promotion and acceptance of inequality provides a justification for why it's okay that some people shop at a dollar store and spend $5 a week, and that's their weekly outing, and some people have never seen a dollar store and, you know, have two yachts. I mean, the growing inequality has to be explained, and it has to be justified if it's going to continue. And that is one of the ways in which it happens.
So are you saying that batterers think that they deserve to be able to batter and to dominate and control?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, there's a certain, I think, entitlement and a belief that it's acceptable to do that, because if it wasn't acceptable, in most cases, they wouldn't. There are some people who may be out of control or who are mentally ill, right? We're not talking about those people. But in general, there is the expectation that they will get away with it. And we've certainly seen on the national stage plenty of that just in recent months, right? Sexual assault on, you know, Fox News and even the president and his comments about sexually assaulting women. It's not stupid on their part to believe that nothing will happen as a result of those actions. So I think there's the message that it's okay, and I think that's the message that they believe in and subscribe to and act on.
Okay. And there probably is something of, this is the way it's always been, and so this is what we're going to continue.
As I said, I've heard many, many times people in abuser groups say to me, it's only natural that I'm in charge, that I have everything, that I'm the boss. And it could be, I think, that it is only natural. I think biologists and anthropologists are showing us that we probably have a lot in common with our ancestors who were resource-grabbing, selfish, domineering people. I think we know that to be true. However, upon reflection, we don't have to do that. There were a lot of things that Neanderthal probably did that maybe we'd even like to do, but we've decided not to, right? So just because something is natural doesn't mean that it's inevitable. The second part of this is that there must be consequences, right? Very few people change something that is working for them if there are no negative consequences. And when it comes to domestic violence and a lot of other bad behavior, the consequences are really light and few. Mm. So we either have to have natural consequences, which is probably part of another interview where we can talk about what those really are, I think, for people who are abusive, natural consequences, or we have to impose them, right, by authorities like our courts.
Or we have to make it so that they're more comfortable or they like it better not being abusive, right? I mean, that's a possibility.
Yes, or we have to provide incentive for them to decide that it is better to not be abusive. And in fact, that is what people who work with abusers are doing all the time. There's kind of a little process. The first is to help people become aware of what they're doing, to challenge the idea that that behavior is natural and that maybe it's not inevitable, to help people reflect on why they behave the way they do, what they believe, what they feel, what they want, what they're trying to achieve, getting them to reflect so that they can then make a choice, right? Many, many abusers and many politicians will tell you, oh, we had no choice. Oh, I'm sorry. We had to take health care and throw it in the garbage because we just had no choice. In fact, that's really not true. A person who's been out here to New Mexico a few times, my organization has brought her out here, Anat Shankar Osorio, wrote a book called Don't Buy It. And her basic point is that we talk about the market as if it were an entity, and it's a free market, and we should just let it do whatever it wants, and we're not making choices, it's the market. That's really not the case. We're making choices. We're making policy choices about who's going to get what, and we're doing that all the time. And when we allow our politicians to talk about the market as if choices aren't being made, when we allow abusers to talk about abuse as if choices weren't being made, oh, I don't know how that happened to my wife. I don't know how she wound up on the floor. She flew out the window, right? In fact, choices are always being made, and we have to become clear about that. So we need reflection, we need the recognition that we do have choices, and then we can consider change.
I'm talking to Pam Wiseman, who is the head of the Coalition Against Domestic Violence Programs in New Mexico.
A friend of mine said to me that she wanted to write a book for abusers, and she was going to call it How to Get More. And I thought, oh, you're kidding me, right? You're not going to write a book called How to Get More. And she said, yes, I am, because I think that abusers don't know how to get what it is they want. Most of them feel powerless. They want power, but nothing that they do ever really works exactly like they think. And so I would like to, she said, show them how they could get more and have a better life. And that makes quite
in a
different way. It makes quite a bit of sense. The problem, I think, for us as people who work in violence is that our competition's message, the most popular message out there, really is about winning and getting more and being right and getting it all for yourself and being selfish. And that's a pretty powerful message, and lots of people buy into it. And our message is more about being, you know, nicer and more empathic and compassionate. And our message appears to be about losing and getting less. And their message is about winning and getting more. And that's a pretty big challenge for us. In fact, we don't have a word for what it is that we want. I think in 2016, the Oxford Dictionary, you know, had their words of the year, and a runner-up was a Danish word. I think it was called hygge. I probably didn't pronounce that correctly. It means a feeling of coziness and contentment or something like that, right? So it's one word that captures what you'd ordinarily have to use five or six or seven words to be able to explain. In domestic violence, we have no word. We do not have a word for the kind of person that we're talking about in terms of the right use of power. We don't have that, and our political leadership doesn't have it either, right? We don't know what it's like to be a good, responsible, powerful person in a way that serves other people and helps society. All we really know is about winning and being right. And the very same thing is true with most of the abusers that I've worked with over the years. They would die rather than be wrong. It's really all about that sort of being on top. Again, that probably is kind of a biological, genetic kind of trait, but we might want to think about how we can move away from that.
Are you suggesting that in order to actually progress with this, that the world has to change? I mean, it seems like that's what you're asking for.
Yeah, that won't be too hard. So I think it's like this, right? I believe that there is an abusive culture that sort of floating around, and people attach to it, and they say to themselves, I like this. I'm going to, you know, do more of this. But on the other hand, a culture, you know, doesn't just change, but people do. So the question is, how do you do both? How do you keep people from being so rewarded by an abusive culture, being so attracted to it? And I don't know if I know the answer to that. I do know that our Native American friends, I have a story, and I hope I haven't told this before on this show, I may have. It's about a beautiful old forest, right? And in this forest, some of the trees are beginning to get sick, and some of them have even died. So the trees get together and decide that they need to go to tree detox, right, for 30 days. And so they do that, and they get fertilizer and sunlight, right, and they're healed, and they come back to the forest, and they're all excited and happy, and they put their roots back into the soil, and they are suddenly infected again. Because it's not the trees, it's the soil in which they are growing. So it's contagious, right? And so the way to stop it is to both heal the trees and heal the soil at the same time. It's both the culture and the abusive culture and the people who subscribe and carry the abusive culture forward. We have to do both, and we have to do it at the same time. To do one without the other will be ineffective.
Do you think that's possible? Have you ever seen it done?
I think I may be naive, but I think that I kind of believe in karma. That's one thing, right? And I think that for all of the people who are acting out of this abusive worldview, who are indifferent to the suffering of other people and animals and the environment, and people who really want more for themselves at the expense of everyone else. And there are a lot of those people. We're accepting of that kind of behavior. I really believe that will come back around, and the chickens will come home to roost. And that will be the world that these people are creating, is the world that they and their family are going to have to live in eventually. I think there is no escaping that. So I think what goes around comes around is the other way of saying this. And I think that we are reaching that point. We are on a trajectory where selfishness and winning and being right and being violent are so common that we will reach a point where it will be enough. And I think we've already started, right? We have a fairly large, I think, resistance movement. I was reading a book by a man named Tim Snyder who writes about tyranny, and he referred to a concept he called anticipatory obedience, which resonated for me, which means that before anyone even asks you to comply, you do it voluntarily out of fear, right? And you begin to go along with policies that are harmful. So if we say, it's okay if old people don't get Meals on Wheels, and it's okay if little kids don't get breakfast or lunch, every time we begin to kind of go along with these things, right, we make it easier and easier. And I think our job now is to make things harder and harder, and to expose at every turn bad, selfish behavior, and to, like we do with abusers, to suggest that there are consequences, that we need to reflect, that that's what civilized people do. We reflect on how we are, and that we stop pretending that we have no choice about these things, that they just happen, that selfishness is just natural, that the free market just is what it is, and that we begin to choose in ways that benefit everyone and not just a few people. Those are the lessons that we learned from abusers and that we can also apply to them. I think it goes both ways.
Do you see us as at a real turning point right now? Because it isn't as though we've always had a great surfeit of selfishness politically or in general. Do you think that things are sort of reaching a maximum and then they're going to change?
Well, that's the hope, right? I mean, I think, you know, people look out into the world and they go, wow, if I behave really badly, I can, you know, run and win high elected office. and then I can have a whole bunch of money and a whole bunch of power and things will be great. It seems like there are no rewards, really, for being good and decent people, and plenty of rewards for being the opposite. And I think that that will have effects. We know that inequality results in the erosion of trust in institutions, in each other. It causes crime and dangerousness. Inequality is extremely detrimental to a society. And the more we allow it and the greater it becomes, the more the consequences will be felt. There's a man named Jared Diamond. He wrote a book called Collapse: How Societies Choose to Succeed or Fail. And his main point really is that when people are too far away from the consequences of their actions, that's when societies fail. And you could certainly argue that the very rich, the gated community people, you know, the I don't shop at the dollar store crowd, that the consequences for them are so far removed, right, that they aren't learning from them. They're not adjusting their behavior and they're not making right decisions. So you have to see the consequences of your behavior. We learn from our consequences. But if you don't feel them, then you don't. And that's when things fall apart.
But on the other hand, maybe the inequality just gets more and more, and the two groups, the ones who are taking and the ones who are getting taken, maybe they just keep going further and further apart.
Well, it certainly has happened, right? I mean, throughout history. But if you look at things as a pendulum, a swing, or, you know, however you want to think about that, I believe that will change. I mean, that may happen. It may get worse. While a few will benefit and the rest of us will decline, I don't know that that's ever, you know, been the case any place forever. Mm-hmm. I think our hope is that we have to challenge this, mm-hmm. right? We have to challenge it, because if we just sort of try to accept it. And I know so many people who do that. Oh, it's going to be okay. And a lot of people said it was going to be okay in places where it was certainly not okay, right? And we don't need to go into that, right? I mean, the Germans certainly thought that none of the things that happened to them would ever have happened to them. So I think awareness, exposure, reflection, and challenging some of the ideas and the justifications for these behaviors that sound good, but surely produce something not very good.
Seems like we need to bring it back to domestic violence in New Mexico and the evaluation that's happening now. We've had, just to remind people, we had a task force that was evaluating batterers intervention and dealing with that. And this is a bigger evaluation that we're in the midst of right now, is looking at domestic violence services in New Mexico and whether they're successful or not, and where they're going, essentially. It seems like we should let listeners know just what constitutes domestic violence services in New Mexico right now.
New Mexico has about, give or take, 29 or 30 programs that provide a range of services. Shelter, immediate, like emergency shelter, housing, services for children, which are pretty new for us, batterers intervention, advocacy people to help victims go to court, counseling, helping people access community resources, doing all the things that people need to do when they're coming out of violence. So our programs provide those services and more.
How much money do we have involved in that?
So statewide through CYFD, about $12 million. For all of those programs. So it sounds like a lot of money, but when you consider the amount of services and the number of people and the fact that they are emergency services, right? So they're like the fire department. They have to be there all the time. And so those services are expensive to operate, but very necessary.
Okay. And what do we have as far as federal resources?
So the Family Violence Protection and Services Act Bureau provides states with money for domestic violence, and the state of New Mexico gets about $1 million from them.
That's all?
That's all. Through the Crime Victims Reparation Commission. They get money from VOCA, which is the Victim of Crime Act, and also VAWA, Violence Against Women Act monies. And they get a fair amount. I'm not entirely sure what it is now, but it went up extensively over the last year. We know that there has been some discussion at the federal level about lessening the amount of grant money going to VAWA and possibly also to VOCA. So I think our programs are just waiting and hoping.
Okay. What do you think that the evaluation will come out with? What do you think that the result will be?
I don't know, but what I hope will happen and what I have heard might happen is that there are the recognition that domestic violence is a macro-level problem. It is a societal-level problem, and it requires more than just fixing up individual people, whether that's a victim or a child or a perpetrator, that a lot of work has to be done with the criminal justice system and other systems that impact victims and their children if we're going to see any change. It's a much bigger problem. It's not like someone comes in and you give them a pill and then they're not a domestic violence offender anymore or they're not a victim anymore. We have to look at how the entire system operates and, in particular, the kinds of messages that people get. We know that if domestic abusers get the message that violence will not be tolerated, it is much less likely that they will be violent again. That's an extremely important thing for the court to do, to say that was a bad thing you did, don't do it again, and to impose a consequence. When the courts don't do that, when there's no message or the message is, oh, we don't really care, you didn't show up for your batterers program, doesn't make any difference anyway, then that's worse than if the person had never been arrested at all. Mm-hmm. Because then it's become very clear to them that they can get away with it, and that no one's going to mind too much, and there's no reason to change. So consequences and message about the unacceptability of violence is critical. And I'm not saying that we want to just lock everybody up, right? That's not the point. The point is for someone in authority to say, this is not how we do things here, this is not how you behave, we don't want you to do this, and if you do it again, there are going to be increasingly difficult consequences to bear.
Can you give me an estimate of where we are as opposed to other states? Do we have more violent people? Because people are talking about an increase of violence in New Mexico.
I don't know that I could say that New Mexico is more violent than any other state. But I can say that, I mean, and most people may already know this, that life, we're 49th or 50th, with one being good and 50 being bad, in terms of overall child welfare. Lots of children in this state are being exposed to domestic violence. The staff at Child Protective Services estimate that domestic violence is a part of 80% of their child abuse cases, right? So it's very prevalent. And the issue is, for me, that for kids who are exposed to violence, whether it's violence in their homes or violence outside in their neighborhoods, they are growing up in a dangerous place. Many will grow up to lack empathy. And as a result, they will themselves, because they see the world as dangerous, they will respond as if the world was dangerous, and that will mean that they'll respond with aggression. And it just keeps piling on and on. And if we don't do something about this very soon, we're going to be condemned to many decades of increasing violence. It needs to stop. The coalition has received money from CYFD and several other organizations to help these children because we often see them. And the good news is that we know that the effects of violence, of being exposed to violence, can be stopped. They can even be reversed. But we have to be able to get these kids into our programs and to see them for that to happen. The behavioral health services are not adequate. The criminal justice system isn't adequate. Substance abuse services are not adequate. All of these things are absolutely required to make this a safer place. And if we're looking at costs, and I know that we are, the cost to New Mexico is in the billions, right? Lost productivity, hospital, courts, substance abuse, physical problems, mental health problems. Domestic violence costs this state a fortune. And anything we can do to lessen it, we ought to do.
But you didn't say how we compared to other states.
I don't know that I know. I mean, I know that we're often high when we'd like to be low and low when we'd like to be high. And we've all gotten, I think, kind of used to that. And so I don't know that I would be prepared to say or would even want to say that New Mexico is more violent than any other state. I mean, we have our crime rates are fairly high, right, compared to other states. You can certainly look that up. But that's not just domestic violence. That's all kinds of crimes, right? I think that it's possible that the domestic violence and other crime will simply worsen here unless and until we address it. And that means courts have got to respond in a different way than they do now. Mm. And there have to be more services for victims, for children, and for offenders. There has to be more outreach. There has to be more prevention. We have to talk about it more. There's no reason to think that we can't do something about this. In order for there to be a way, there has to be a will. And that's what we require.
Just go back over what we've been talking about, because we've been talking about a lot of different things. You're saying that it may help us to understand what's happening politically, nationally, if we look at the actors as the way we might look at abusers and we apply the same kind of standards to them.
I think that's right. I think the larger question is what happens when there is inequality, whether it's inequality in a home where one person has all the money, has the resources, gets to make the decisions, and other people don't, or whether we're talking about a society, right, where a relative few get to have a lot and most people have a lot less. What happens in an abuser's home? That kind of inequality rarely lasts. Those homes often collapse under the weight of the inequality. And I'm suggesting that we might learn something from that, because what happens in people's homes when there is abuse may well be the sort of thing that happens to all of us if we allow that kind of inequality and abusive leadership to continue.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting that everyone is abusive. I'm suggesting that there are a relative few, and that's all it takes to make for a society in which a lot of people are harmed. For example, we can't say, I know that we're against domestic violence, but what do you do with domestic violence, right? Do you put it in jail? What do you do with patriarchy, right? Do you shake your finger at it and say, stop being so patriarchy?
Okay. So what do you want listeners to do? What do you want us to do?
So I think that what we need people to do is fortunately what many of them are doing, right? We had a women's march that was enormous, and we have people protesting. We have our media, who perhaps have not always been our best friends in some ways, but who have really stepped up to the plate and who are doing the kinds of investigations that we need. So I think it takes all of us. Just as we know that domestic violence is not going to end person by person, right? One victim is able to leave an abuser, the abuser finds someone else. We have to challenge the ideas and we have to strongly resist them. And I think that's exactly what's happening. I also think we need to just mince no words about this. I think the time for being polite, if ever there were a time, is probably over. I think we have to be clear that what we are living under now, and what most people feel they are living under, is an abuse of leadership. And we can cry, and we can be sad, and lots of people are, and then we have to pick ourselves up, and we have to declare that we will not be victims.
Okay, good.